Well, a bunch of stories have come out this week. Tim Gordon and I were looking at all of them, like, how are we going to do all of these in the next hour and a half or hour? So we've got the bishop in Chile who denied communion to at least two people who were asking for communion on the tongue, on their knees. We also have the story of Pope Francis sending $500,000 to migrants in Mexico who are trying to find asylum in the United States, which actually was kind of a political trick to make Trump look bad. And it looks like Francis is piling on here towards the end. We have this new news that Cardinal Casper, that he attended a meeting before the conclave that elected Bergoglio as Pope Francis, in which he said that they tallied the votes to see if Bergoglio would have enough votes. And also this news of the Pope saying evangelization is above doctrine, which is pretty problematic. So a lot of things that we need to cover today. Can we do it, Tim?
I'm sure we will.
Can we run it?
Yeah, we will. We'll muscle up and get it done. Evangelization, I thought, was a four-letter word for Pope Francis. Remember?
Mm.
He always calls it...
He's always about he's always against proselytizing.
But secretly, I always thought the byplay here was that all evangelizing, serious-minded evangelizing, is proselytizing for him. I thought that's the game he's at.
Yeah. See, he, if you look at his statements that he made in North Africa a few months ago, he seems to say that evangelization is without words. Like someone says, I'm thirsty, right? And you're like, here's a Coke. And you're like, I want to be baptized. That's so cool.
Right.
Like, what's this baptism thing in the Nicene Creed? I want to learn about that. So he's like, he likes that. But yeah, if you compel people by any sort of duress, that is proselytizing.
But you're not allowed to compel people by duress, A. B, Christianity has never compelled people by duress since, what, the days of Leo III or whatever, you know, to sweetness of preaching. And C, he seems to love Islam, which is all about compelling people by the sword. So,
yeah, I know.
Pick a lane.
It's a problem. Pick a lane. But also, you know, you got all these modern liberation theology people who come on and they say, hey, you know, these people went into Dakar, into the French Guinea and all these places, and they set up schools and they set up wells and clothes and food. And that was, in a sense, holding these carrots in front of these people. And that's proselytizing by improving their life.
It is.
If 75% of the village says, well, we want to be baptized, right, and receive all these benefits of Christendom, that's proselytizing. You shouldn't do that.
Super mean to build it's someone
super
home.
Mean
and, yeah. and to bring them
here's
salvation.
Clean water and literacy in books and schools, and what we're also going to protect all the females from getting raped and protect their rights in society. So they think that's bad. They don't like that.
Quit bringing the patriarchy.
Yeah, that's why missions have died. They don't do, you know, no one does missions anymore. We just go to, you know, the Dalai Lama and we take pictures with them.
Yeah.
Like, here's a Coke, Dalai Lama. You want to get baptized?
That's going to make a difference.
Yeah,
no.
Exactly.
He's like, no, thank you. I was kind of interested in it, and I was hoping that you guys would bring a brochure or something, but you brought me nothing. So now I'm just going to drink the Coke and stick with what my thing is. So, yeah. I don't know. So, yeah, there's that. Proselytizing, baptizing. Maybe they were like, hey, you want to get tized? And he just assumed that we assumed it was proselytized instead of baptized.
He's like, I don't like Thai food.
I'm not into that, man.
So actually happened to me once, Tim. I was at a mass. This is when I actually tried to go the Novus Ordo and make it work to get daily masses. It's a daily mass, not far from my house. And the priest, the lesson was on the Maccabees. He's like, the Maccabees, they fought for their Jewish identity, for the religion given by God. I was like, man, this priest is on fire today. I don't usually hear this. He goes, we Catholics need to fight the culture. We need a Catholic culture. We need to have everything Catholic. We shouldn't be embarrassed about it. I was like, fantastic. And he goes, and Muslims, we need Muslims to fight for Islam and their culture, and we need to encourage them to be the best Muslims that they can be. I was like, whoa, hold on. Tap the brakes, bud.
Yeah.
Tap the brakes. So I walked out of Mass, of course, and I was in the parking lot leaving, and I called my wife and told her what happened. She's like, well, you need to go back. She's like, unless men actually talk to the clergy and confront them on this, nothing's going to happen. I was like, you're right. You know, so I turned back around, went into the parking lot, waited outside the sacristy. And I was real nice. I said, hey, Father, I just got a question about your homily today. He was nice about it. He said, yeah, what's up? I said, I heard you saying, maybe I was wrong, but I heard you saying that we as Catholics need to encourage all Muslims to be the best Muslims they can be. He goes, that's exactly what I said. And I said, well, I mean, I thought when we were confirmed, we became soldiers for Christ. And we wanted to evangelize the whole world. And Jesus said in Matthew 28, go therefore baptizing all nations in the name of the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit. So shouldn't we do that? He goes, ah, Muslims are monotheists. Do you know what that is? He actually said that. Do you know what that
is? Did he?
Yeah.
It's a tough concept.
I know. I said, yes, I know what that is. And he goes, so they worship the same God as us. It's the same thing. So we don't need to proselytize them. And I said, and then I said, well, I don't want to proselytize them. I want to evangelize them. He goes, ah, you haven't been reading Pope Francis. Have you read what Pope Francis says? I was like, oh, man, this is going bad. He goes, as long as people follow their consciences, they'll go to heaven.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
How recent was this?
This is a few years ago. And then I said, well, it has to be a well-formed conscience. And he goes, well, there's this guy named Thomas Aquinas. He says this to me. There's this guy named Thomas Aquinas who says, even if you follow your conscience wrongly, you're still without guilt. And I said, nah. And then I started citing some Summa, and he was like, what the heck is going on here, right? I mean, I wrote my PhD on natural law. And I said, no, it has to be a well-formed conscience in accord with natural law and, when available, divine revelation.
Right.
There's a moral obligation to do that. And if we tell them to follow Islam, we're telling them to follow polygamy, child rape. I just listed all the stuff, you know. I said all of that is against the divine revelation of Jesus Christ, whom they claim to follow in a way as a prophet. And it's against natural law. So you in a sermon are telling us to go out there and malform their consciences by encouraging them to be good Muslims. And then he said, that's the problem with you fundamentalists. When a girl is pregnant, you won't let her have an abortion, but you don't even help her. Did you follow the train of thought there, Tim? It's like, what?
It's pretty tight reasoning. I mean, you got to give it to him.
He's like, that's the problem with you fundamentalists. I said, well, we weren't talking about abortion. And A, I actually do help raise money and help women who are pregnant. And it doesn't relate to this. And I was like, you've called me a fundamentalist. I was like, this, you know, thanks for talking, but this is over.
We've both been brightened by this.
I know. But this is what it's like in the Catholic Church. It is a different religion. You know, he is quoting Francis against me and against Thomas to make his point that we should not be evangelizing people. And what we should, and in that same homily, he said, I want you to pray for me. I'm going to the mosque to speak. They invited me to speak. And of course they invited him to speak because he's going to go there and talk about how awesome they are.
Right. Benedict Arnold. You can come talk at the British reception hall any day of the week.
All day. Yeah. They didn't invite.
I wonder why.
Fraternity of St. Peter priest to come preach at the mosque. I wonder why.
Yeah, he should have just brought the Regensburg address with him. Remember after that in 2006, everyone started lighting things on fire. Yeah, you know what I like to say now that it's no jokes or whatever, but I think is really effective, more effective than what I used to say, is the rhetorical question. Does everyone not in the world have the right to the truth, like capital T truth? Does everyone in the world not have the right to Jesus Christ? This is why we do need, this is why it's undeniable. It's not just for Catholic monarchists, people that believe in a Catholic republic like myself or a Catholic aristocracy or whatever kind of regime you have. It doesn't matter. For all of those, the social doctrine of Christ's kingship is the only way. And here's why. The justification for it is the only thing that squares with justice or any kind of natural law. Do I, because I happen to live in a post-Protestant nation, have more of a right to the truth, right? To the way, the life, and the truth of Jesus Christ, to the truth, baby T, the truth, capital T, than some guy that has the misfortune of being born into dirty water and, you know, whatever.
Right.
Iran? Like, of course not. I'm not special. So that you have to turn the table on these guys and be like, so right. What are you being racist, Father?
Yes, now white privilege.
Yeah, white privilege. Do you think, are you saying that I'm better than that guy? Because that's what I heard you say.
Yeah.
You're saying that literally that guy deserves less of a chance to get Jesus than me. And they'll be like, no, I'm not saying. And they'll be like, or are you saying that it's not the ultimate privilege, the raison d'etre of our lives, right? Purpose to be reunited with Jesus, the truth and the life. And then he can't say no there and then be like, it sounds like that's what you're saying.
Yeah.
A jumbo.
That is what he's saying is, let's just not make people feel bad.
What he's saying is Jesus doesn't really matter.
It's what,
when it comes down to it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. These conversations with people, especially when you're in intramural debates with other Catholics and they're talking about this. Like, well, yeah, but the Muslim, you know, he's a good guy and he's devout and he does Ramadan. And I say, look, the most important thing in our lives as Catholics is the Eucharist. You're saying he doesn't need the Eucharist. He's cool. No Eucharistic life for him. That's what you really want for him? Like, well, no. Like, that's what you're saying. I mean, it's kind of like the saying. Jesus argument, but you like make it even more Catholic. You're saying he doesn't need baptism. Same thing when people debate Judaism. Well, all Jewish people go to heaven. That's what they say. You got Jewish DNA. Good luck for you. You're going to heaven. Well, I don't know. I mean, don't they need baptism? And, you know, what about confirmation? We say they don't need confirmation, Eucharist, knowing Our Lady, all these like benefits of being a Catholic. You're saying, nah, they don't need that. That's kind of mean, actually.
It's super mean.
It's meany.
That's what I like to tell them. Like, yeah, it's heartless, bro.
Yeah.
You know? But you know what you didn't know that he brought up that explodes the whole argument in your face? He knew what a monotheist was, and he did. So in your face.
I know.
Take that. It's funny.
He's like, do you know what that is? I was like, yes.
You should have said no. You should have been like,
oh, can you explain that to me? Monotheism?
It sounds like a $10 word.
But see, if we distill our conversation, he, as an elderly priest, he was old, believes that Catholic lay people don't know what these terms mean. Evangelize, proselytize, monotheist, conscience, right? Damn, pretty much assume that me as a lower middle-aged guy had no clue on any of this stuff, that I just like play golf, coming to daily mass, and I'm just sort of spaced out there and have no idea what my faith means.
Yeah.
It's kind of condescending, I guess.
To be fair, you are a guy in this culture, and it's almost a safe assumption. But
true.
You are like an American guy in this culture, and a lot of American guys are out there scratching their head like, what's up with that? Monotheist, that's a tough word.
Yeah. Or maybe he's had that conversation. It's been a trump card for him. And he says, well, do you know what a monotheist is? And the person's like, no, what is that? And like, people who only believe in one God. And so we only believe in one God. Jewish people only believe in one God. And
they do.
Muslims only. And when the person's like, oh, so you're saying that it's all good. And he's like, bingo, go make a difference.
Go worship your one God. With the Muslim guy, if he doesn't blow you up first.
Right.
Because you'll be great.
Did you realize he was so quick to tag me as the fundamentalist?
Yeah. As soon as you said Thomas Aquinas. Well,
as soon as I quoted Summa, he was like shields down.
Sometimes these guys will quote Aquinas, but if you quote any work by Aquinas, not just from like a daily devotional book, you know how a lot of people.
Or what they heard in class 30 years ago.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. But if you're like, oh, yeah, this is Summa Contra Gentiles or, you know, Thomas's commentary on the ethics, he actually says everything you said. So good job, Father. yeah. golf clap, but accept the opposite of it. But yeah. the opposite. All right. So super for you.
Yeah.
Two thumbs up, tough guy. Yeah. That's Then once you're getting in the text by Thomas Aquinas, like uh oh, this is a deplorable alert, and then they call you.
You drop like Ancient Theologiae Prima Secunda, question 94, article 2.
When you're like, talking abort. About
what he's like, yeah, he's like, oh no, this fundamentalist.
There's
all these crying pregnant lady, and this guy wants to put his foot on their neck and not give them any money. And say, you have to have that baby.
And you have to have that baby, and I'm not going to help you. Though, I mean, I don't know. I'll kind of stick up for that point of view. It's like, if you're pregnant, you do have to have the baby unless you want to commit murder. And you're not guaranteed, that is to say, you don't have, in terms of natural justice, you don't have a right to anybody else's money or property just because you got pregnant. So,
yeah,
like, I'll be that guy. Like, yeah, it's. I mean, I get what you're saying, because you probably donated to pregnant, you know, moms who keep the baby shelters or whatever they're called. But this is good. You know, you get points for that. But I mean, on the other hand, it's kind of like, well, yeah, I guess I'm a deplorable. I don't believe in murder. And I know you progressives. I know how you work. Once you start once every 25 years, whether it's, you know, this kind of socialism, national socialism, international socialism, some socialist cause, you always start locking people away in concentration camps because you're the secular humanist, you're the progressives, this is what you do. I don't believe in murder. You start calling me a deplorable because I say murder is wrong.
Right.
I guess I'll be that guy.
Well, in my work, you know, you go to a life pregnancy center. You know, they're all over Texas helping these young ladies. And you go to the fundraisers, you go to the dinners, you meet the volunteers. You know, all the ladies running the sonogram machines in these places often volunteer time. They're all Catholic or Protestant. I've yet to meet a Muslim one volunteering her time at the crisis pregnancy center. Same thing. You know, you don't meet any atheists, secularists. This is all anecdotal, I know. Okay, so don't hold my feet to the fire. But in my experience, and you go to the fundraisers, it's 85% Catholic, 15% Protestant at these things. And these are devout people. These are people who pray every day and go to church every Sunday.
Yeah.
The people who are out there helping these girls aren't his audience, who are like, yay, Muslims are so cool. Let's encourage them to be Muslims. Those aren't the people running the sonogram machines and counseling these ladies.
Well, the Muslim response, dare I say, to an unwanted pregnancy, an out-of-wedlock pregnancy, an illegitimate one, is a little bit different, isn't it? By the family of many Muslims, globally speaking, right? I this is what you should have told the good priest, is that it's slightly more deplorable response by Muslim family. This is where you get into honor killing time, and you know it gets pretty ugly from the things I read.
Yeah, but we should just encourage them, says he, to be better Muslims.
Right,
be the best Muslim you can be.
Right,
as a Muslim, make a difference.
Go make a difference. They do. Oh, they do.
You know, it's interesting, the secular left, they have watched Christianity, Catholic and Protestant. And I know Christianity is Catholicism. You don't have to correct me on that. I'm just using colloquial terms here. But they have watched over the 100 years, in a sense, an infiltration of Christianity, where they have seen the religion change. Catholicism has changed. 1900, everybody in the block was pro-death penalty in the Polish and Irish neighborhood, right? 2019, not so much. Right?
Right.
So it's changed. And so the liberal thinks, well, we changed Catholicism. It only took us like 150 years. We changed Catholicism. The Pope says basically what we want the Pope to say. That's great. So if we can do that with Catholicism, we can do it with Islam. We'll just make Islam eventually give up on Sharia, give up on death penalty, give up on honor killings, give up on the burqa and all that, just like we did to Catholicism. I mean, you went to church in 1915. Every single female in the building has her head covered. Go look at the pictures. It was in canon law.
Yeah.
It's in the Bible.
Yeah. Yeah.
2019, you go into Catholic Church, it's less than 5%, maybe even less than 1%.
It's pretty low. Yeah.
So the liberal Hillary thinks, hey, we did this with Catholicism. In 100 years, we could do it with Islam. We'll make them into secular leftists that hold a Quran.
Remember, when you're dealing with libs, it's a spectrum of naivete. Like with some of them, yeah, there's probably maybe the higher bona fides one with better souls, more naivete. I think you're right. But like with the ones that understand what the liberal program is, or really the radical progressive program, I don't know. There's at least ones among them that are like, well, no, Islam will never change, but they'll kill everyone, and that's good because there are too many people on the earth, and they'll destroy the Western civilization, and that's good because Western civilization is phallocentric and Eurocentric and evil. So that's always whenever I remember I used to have about 11 years ago, I had this Sunday night radio program with my brother on radio, and we'd be talking about these issues more often because, like I said, Islam was a bigger deal then, right?
Yeah. The
late Bush presidency, all that. 2006, 2007 is when I had it. And it's like we'd get into these discussions. They're important discussions to have. But with Islam, as it interfaces with liberal leftism, Western liberal leftism, it's really, really just a queer pairing, right? It's they make strange bedfellows. And I think this is humanity's all-time strangest bedfellow. Because they're so very different, Islamo-fascism and secular white liberalism, particularly this white bougie liberalism.
Yeah,
they're like polar opposites. So they're among those on the left, I think there's the spectrum of expectations. A lot of them are like, yeah, look what we did, look how easy it was. It was so easy to do to Roman Catholicism. Yeah. I really think it was easy for them. I mean, which is. You got the book on it now. It took them shorter than they thought. They thought it might take 100 years. It really only took, 50, 60, 70.
Alta Vendita says maybe a century. That's in 1840s. So, I mean, by the 1940s and 50s, they're definitely in the seminaries and in the major faculties of Europe. By the late 50s. And then, as I say in Infiltration, the modernization, the liberalization happened in the 40s and the 50s. Vatican II was the parade. It was the victory lap.
Right, right.
It was like, okay, we're all good here. Okay, right. Let's all step out. Nothing's going to happen. Yeah.
Yeah, so it's like, you're tracking it middle 1840s to like middle 1940s. Middle 1940s is when America, which was one of the last bastions of the old world order, was really that's when full on Masonic type secularism won out, was after the World War. That's where I've talked about it a lot here. It's where the Supreme Court got infiltrated by Masons 7, 8 out of 9. And that's when they destroyed the meaning of the Constitution as it relates to religion. So they reversed the meaning. So people are always thinking, I mean, this has become my pet peeve, Taylor, in general, not just church and state relations or, infiltration of the actual Roman church or whatever, but including the sexual immorality, sexual revolution. All of this stuff was done, even feminism. People, this is, of course, the book I'm working on. Oh, feminism, really the first real bad strain of feminism was in the 1960s. Just no. All of the groundwork was set. No, it was all set in the late 1800s.
Yeah.
It all happened in the late 1800s, which is what your book's about, right?
Yeah.
It's undeniable anyone that looks at the provenance of these ideas.
Yeah, I mean, I think of it, Pius X was, do you know what the game whack-a-mole is? Do y'all have that?
Like, is it like whack-a-mole?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like whack-a-mole.
Yeah. Yeah,
but in down here in Texas, it sounds like guacamole. Because we have guacamole. For people who know, you take avocado, smash them up, dip chips in it. It's wonderful. Do it.
Yeah.
Don't miss out on life. was hunting this week, past weekend, and every meal there was a giant bowl of guacamole on the table, fresh.
Yeah,
it's the best stuff ever. There's like, whatever you're eating, you need this.
Yeah,
it's like the elixir of life.
If you go to any kind of dinner party, spring or summer dinner party in California, it's just it's become like the condiment of choice, just out on the table before you eat.
And it's amazing. You put it on your burgers.
It is good.
You can dip bacon in it. It's all good. Anyway, so there's this thing that like Six Flags called the Whack-A-Mole.
Yeah. And you said Whack-A-Mole, but it's a play.
Well, it was probably my Texan, my love for guacamole that came out. It's Whack.
Yeah.
Whack. No, Whack-A-Mole. And these little moles pop up and you have the big round hammer thing and you're like hitting them. That was Pius the X. Right. So all this stuff happened in the 1800s. Pius the X in the early 1900s, in that first decade, he's like, oh, my gosh. And he's trying to knock them all down. He's doing everything he can. Oath Against Modernism. Right. Pashendi, you know, setting up his little secret service that's investigating everybody. But then after that, no one is sounding the alarms as loud as Pius the X was.
Right.
They're looking to other stuff. I mean, Pius the 12th canonized Pius the 10th, and he was a little bit better, but it was kind of, so by the time we get to the 40s and 50s, those moles that were kind of popping up, there's now like 10,000 of them under the surface.
They're running the garden. Yeah.
And then in the 1960s, they're like, when I say go, everybody pop up, and you had 1,000 moles pop up at one time. And there's a guy like Gary Gulagrange who had the whacker, and he's like, oh man,
yeah,
we're surrounded.
Yeah. Yeah.
He tried to take out a few, but by then it was too, it was more like one of those war movies where you're like, no, and you sacrifice yourself. You're not going to make it.
Suicide mission. It's a suicide mission by the 1960s when it's like you said, it was either right below the surface or even above the surface and just kind of undercover.
Yeah.
And already above the surface, eating the plants just quietly or whatever, all the mole. I don't even know if moles do that. But like, yeah, taking over the garden, just kind of camouflage. And then the 1960s was just, okay, everyone break cover. We've cleared the place. It's like SWAT team when they clear the place. It's like, we own it. And we've owned it for some decades, but now we own that we own it.
Yeah.
That's the 1960s. People need to get over this. The generation of the 1940s led to the 1960s. There's a really important Russian book about when Russia was radicalized. It's called, and many people know, it's called Fathers and Sons by Ivan Turgenev. And it's all about how the liberals of the 1840s in Russia delivered the radicals of the 1860s, and how the attitude, the countenance of the liberals in Russia were kind of like, we didn't really mean it. We were just funning, like Johnny Ringo says to Doc Holliday. And then the liberals, the younger generation, the radicals of the 1860s were like, I wasn't just funning. We're going to get the czar. You know, we're gonna destroy all patriarchy. We're gonna destroy the family. We're gonna do all this stuff. Well, I wasn't just funning. So there's something of that between the liberals who, you know, go by the generation, greatest generation of the 1940s, and then their progeny of the 1960s is kind of like, they were the ones that killed religion before you get to the 1960s. It was dead. It was killed in the 1940s post-war. Look at the post-war literature. Look at the post-war court decisions. Look at the post-war, kind of pragmatic philosophy that comes out in America. It's all very anti-religious in the 1940s. People, it's kind of the worst of WASPiness mixed with a more secularized form of white Anglo-Saxon Protestantism. And it's done. But if you say the 40s to someone that's not very well trained in history of ideas or cultural history, they're like, oh, that was still that really conservative time. And it was really, you know, there's still 20 more years before. Well, I say it was 1962 or 1963 that it all went wrong. It's like all this stuff was set, like your guacamole analogy.
Guacamole. I mean, there's multiple analogies here. We could also think of stirring up the guacamole, smash it. But the moles, that's what it is.
The moles are the thing. Yeah.
The moles. And, you know, I noticed when I was doing the research on this book, Infiltration, Pius XII gets really sick. We've talked about this before, haven't we? In 54, 55.
I'll tell you after you.
Yeah. Where they're pumping his stomach and all that. Have I talked about that yet on the show?
Uh-huh.
Okay, so they're pumping his stomach. He's super sick. So basically from 54, 55 up to 58, he's really ill and he's not performing. You know, I've given up on the evil entourage theory for Francis, Benedict XVI, John Paul II, even Paul VI. The evil entourage theory is also known here on TNT as worm tongue thesis. Worm tongue thesis, right, is that Theoden King is getting bad info and he's possessed by Saruman and Wormtongue.
So a lot of people,
a lot of people say, well, you know, Paul VI was just an awesome dude, like just totally awesome. The problem is he had all these bad counselors and he didn't know the truth. They were hiding the truth. And you get it with JP too, but I think it's kind of true. I've rejected it now for all. I've red pilled on all the popes. I think they knew a lot of stuff and they made serious grave mistakes. But I honestly do. Maybe someone's going to kick the stool out from underneath me. But I think with Pius XII from 54 to 58, those 40 years, he's really ill. And I think the buzzards are surrounding him and they are doing bad things.
Seems to be much, much more fertile ground for leveling it at Pius XII than any of these other guys. Usually when people throw kind of, you know, the worm tongue agency theory at you, it's just that all they're really saying is they're uncomfortable condemning the actions of ex-pontiff or ex-leader. And that's essentially all they're expressing. Obviously it can be a real thing. Manipulation is a real thing, you know, And from what I know, I would agree with you. I don't know as much as extensively, but I knew even before you'd said it that Pius XII had these issues. I know how on fire he was back in the 30s and early 40s, and he seems to lose some of that. So maybe it's just the
you've had gut issues. You know how bad it is.
You're laid out. Yeah. You're laid out.
Gut issues are hard.
It's like the largest sensory organ of the body. Don't go Dwight Schrute on me. I know the skin is the largest organ of the body. But I mean, the largest sensory organ, you got more neurons in your gut than in your brain. And so if you're having stomach issues, you're just in pain and you're doubled up. And so that'll do it. It makes me believe. And there are other things that make me believe as well. There's essentially no reason for facilitating the cases of these later popes, even with the Parkinson's or whatever. It's like, no, all the indicia are there before for us to level Theoden King, you know, worm tongue theory. The seeds of discontent can't really have been there before whatever malady laid them out. They've got to be pretty good and strong, and then, you know, they get sick or weakened or debilitated in whatever way, and then the infiltrator comes in and poisons their words.
Yeah.
But the problem with JP2, with even Benedict, I mean, definitely, I've never even really heard it applied to Francis. I guess I have. Is these guys are doing pretty much what they do, shoot or shoot, right? All along, and then they just, people don't want to blame them, so they look at something bad happens to everyone, you know, whether it's Parkinson's or Benedict just got old and stayed healthy. I mean, he's still healthy.
Yeah.
So whatever. But
yeah, he just wrote his big 6,000 word essay.
Right.
See our YouTube. We have two on that. We have two YouTube videos on that essay.
So, yes, we do.
Yeah. I mean, and then we haven't even discussed Francis stacking evangelization over doctrine. And this just, as soon as I saw that headline, I was like, well, that's a Morris Letizia, guys. Why are y'all surprised? It's you accommodate the truth in order to evangelize. And by evangelize, we mean, in general, make people feel good.
Right. We mean the fake words attributed to St. Francis, which he never said, about evangelize always, use words only when necessary. He never said this, and he didn't believe it, right? He very glowingly, explicitly made you know, tried to convert the Sultan with words. So St. Francis didn't think this. He was the real deal.
Yep.
Pope Francis, on the other hand, says it all the time. I think I tweeted that this is Francis's admonition here is as absurd as saying, I prioritize cooking over recipes and ingredients. It's like one thing's the constituent part of the other. How do you do that? Right. The main thing you're evangelizing, the medium, is the words, but the thing being carried, the meaning conveyed, is doctrine. That's what we're evangelizing.
Truth.
Truth is doctrine.
Yeah, you can't come to a village and evangelize them and say, well, I realize you guys like rice, so we'll have rice hosts, and yeah, it's really hard for y'all on your work week to have Mass on Sunday, so we won't do that either. I mean, like, you can't do that. There are eternal, unchanging elements, and we as humans conform to God. We are made in His image, and we are recreated in His image through baptism. So, you know, I was reading the biography of Marcel Lefebvre. You know, he was the apostolic, what do they call it, delegate to French Guinea, Africa. Like, all that horn that comes out, you know, in Africa, even all the way to Madagascar, the island. He was over all that, Lefebvre.
Was he?
One of the big problems is they come to these villages and they evangelize people like, I want Christ, I want to be baptized, but there's polygamy.
Right.
Now, when the Muslims came through in Africa, they're like, you're polygamist? Awesome. So are we. High five, guys. We're all polygamists.
Sweet.
Yeah. Right. Guess what the Protestants did? They also kind of winked on the polygamy.
Did they?
Yeah. They're like, it's not ideal. We need to get it out in a few generations. But for now, we'll kind of just turn a blind eye to it. Guess what Lefebvre and the Catholic missionary said? No polygamy, guys. No baptism. You cannot come into baptism if you have polygamy, you men.
Right, right.
And it was a big deal. So Lefebvre actually had to, they actually created this side group called, I think it was called Friends of the Christians. These were people in the tribe who liked Christianity, wanted to help support them, but wouldn't give their wives away, wouldn't give up polygamy. And so they were just like, well, you can't become a catechumen. You can't get baptized. You're not in. But we'll kind of recognize you as people that are friendly to us. But unless you do that, no eternal life for you, bud.
Yeah.
That's not very nice.
No. The friendship's not worth very much unless it comes with an admit ticket. Yeah.
And Jesus says, baptize all nations, teaching them.
Right. That's right. That's right.
Teaching
them. That's on point. Yeah. Yeah. And St. Paul says just a lot on evangelization that proves that it has to do. I mean, everything St. Paul says on evangelization is you're going and you're teaching. Everything he did was about teaching. But I mean, I like it's a good analogy. I also like moral theology. Well, I guess that is moral theology because it shows where the thing that normally a Pope Francis type likes to concede is the very topic that you would be bringing to them. I guess that is the heart of your example. Like, well, there's no way to evangelize and then also bring the truth. It's like the truth is the direct object. It is what you're evangelizing. In some cases, think about the prophets. Think about John the Baptist. I mean, he was evangelizing by saying, you can't marry your brother's wife.
That's right.
You can't do this dance, you know, which is how you feel as a person, you know, at a dance proctor nowadays. You can't do this dance. You can't do this behavior. I'm bringing you the truth out of love, but stop doing this stuff. What clearly emerges on Francis's definition of this, and it's good he's made it explicit, I appreciate that, no more weaponized ambiguity, is this is clearly wrong. That's clearly wrong teaching what he's saying. Evangelize, leave aside doctrine. It shows that for him, doctrine is not the direct object of evangelization. Okay, good. I'm glad we've established that now. I don't know what he thinks doctrine is. I don't know what he thinks evangelizing is. I can make a conjecture. But it's 100%. I'm 100% certain now he's misdefining those terms.
Yeah. I suspect that if you went to friends and said, hey, when you sign the Abu Dhabi Accord, that says God wills a plurality and diversity of religions, all that. What went on there? I think Francis would say, I evangelized them. Well, did anyone get baptized? No. Right. But I think he would say that he evangelized them. He said, basically, here's a Coke. Here's a Pepsi. Sorry. Here's a Pepsi. And they're like, thanks. And they smiled and they hugged and they signed a piece of paper. And they were strengthened in their faith to the one true monotheistic God. He would say that's evangelization. Going out and telling someone, hey, unless you believe and are baptized, you can't be saved. That's mean. Right. It's almost like saying, hey, we here at our company, what's more important is not our products, but the sales team.
Right. Sales
is evangelization. Product is the truth. And here, exactly. What's most important is the sales team and the commercials that we make. Mm-hmm. And like, well, what about the actual, I don't know, we can make it be Coke, right? Well, what about the actual Coke? Can we fudge the ingredients and change it? Yeah, whatever, man. What's important is the sales team and the commercials.
Right. So it beggars the question, well, then what is the purpose of the commercials, right? Is what we're asking Francis is like, what's the purpose of just being nice to people if we leave them in their eternal death, right? Which is what it is to remain unevangelized, to remain outside the church. Then you never get that answer because that would require too much doctrinal effacing by Francis. Yeah. He would have to efface doctrine and say, oh, well, everyone goes to heaven no matter what. And the best weapon for that from his point of view is the weaponized ambiguity. He doesn't want to outright attack, you know, extra ecclesiam nulla solus. That's right. Yeah, that's a good analogy, though.
I mean, if he were evangelizing polygamists in Africa, my suspicion is he would say, well, let's baptize these people and then we'll accompany them pastorally over the next several years. We'll find a pastoral solution to this difficult problem in evangelization. Whereas the old school pre-Vatican II way was, let me get this straight. You have two wives. Yes. Okay. You need to only have one wife in order to receive the sacrament of baptism.
Right. Right.
There's no if, ands, or buts about it. That's it. Monogamous relationships. You can't come to church with two wives.
If you don't receive baptism, then no admit. Then you're done. You're out.
It's not like, wink, wink, here's the second path to heaven. No. No. It's like I was an Episcopalian priest. I wanted to become Catholic. That means I had to give up my job, right? I could not be Episcopal priest and be a Catholic layman at the same time. That'd be kind of weird, right? So I had to make some serious decisions in order to come into the truth. You can't come to me and say, we'll continue being an Anglican priest and we'll accompany you along the way. That doesn't make any sense.
Right.
You have sometimes severe decisions and changes in your life in order to be a disciple of Jesus Christ.
Right.
All of us.
Priorities matter, right? Which was a big saying with generations past, priorities matter. And it's like, no, that's true. You're the one telling me this. You want to think about this a little bit? Because they do matter. It's like, if the whole point of life, and this goes to the heart. This evangelization issue goes to the heart of life in the kind of middle and upper middle class suburbs in America. The main idea now, no one will choose a kind of benign therapeutic deism, which is what sociologists now say. This is really what most people in the suburbs believe in first world countries, a benign therapeutic, a moralistic therapeutic deism is, I think, what they call it, MTD. You're not going to shift your priorities in life just for a moral-ish therapeutic deism that makes you feel good, a kind of imaginary God that's either real or imagined, but he just confirms all the things you do. He raises your self-esteem, like that kind of stuff. No one's going to make that shift for that kind of fictitious, pathetic, kind of soppy suburban God. But the real God, the living God, as the Jews call him in the Old Testament, the Jesus Christ, the way, the truth, and the life, is worth moving around anything that needs to be moved around for. In other words, This is the one piece of furniture in the room that I need. I'll move. Everything else is expendable. So if I have to be a little bit poor, I'll be a little bit poor. Right. If I have to be a little bit unpopular, or let's be honest, very unpopular with friends, family, I'll be a little bit or very unpopular with friends, family, or strangers. If I have to be a little bit hungry, I'll be a little bit hungry. So that's the idea.
Yeah.
When something is the truth, this is why doctrine has to be number one. Because doctrine is it true or not true? It's a yes-no determination, up or down. Right. When doctrine's true, right? I mean, when it's true doctrine, then it's just like, this is all I need in life. I mean, I'd like to have a comfortable life. Maybe I'd like to be rich, but Jesus doesn't say I need to be rich. He said it makes it hard to be rich. So I'll go ahead and be poor, or I'll be unpopular, whatever it is. You don't have to own it unless it poses a direct threat to coming into the kingdom, which is all that matters.
Yeah.
And it's not always that simple. It's not always mutually exclusive. But if it is, you make those priorities and you say, this is the one piece of furniture in the room that I truly want to rest upon.
Right. Yep. I mean, you think of the early martyrs. There was many a conversation between the baptized and the bishop. Now, what if I just offer half a grain of incense to the Roman emperor and the Roman gods? It'll spare my life, my whole family. And it's just, and I, in my heart, the whole time I'll be saying, this isn't for him. This isn't for him. And what the bishops and the priests say, no, half a grain of incense to the gods is apostasy. You'll be damned. Do not do it. Go to death. Be a martyr. That's the ultimate. That's a lot harder than giving up one wife. Is giving up your life and maybe even your whole family, right?
That's
over
true.
Over a grain of incense offered to the genius of the Roman emperor. It's a big deal, but we are called to that. Jesus said, take up your cross and follow me, which means you're saying at baptism, when they put the sign of the cross on you at baptism, you are signing up unto death, willful death, like the Sri Lanka martyrs. That's it, folks. Yep. We got to be able, this is real Catholicism.
Right.
What did you call it? What is the suburban?
Moralistic. Therapeutic deism. Look it up. Google it, everybody. That's MTD. What religion is. That's basically what most Novus Ordos people and modern fast secularizing Protestantism and all the other religions, except Islam. It's not moralish. Moralistic therapeutic deism, MTD. Mm-hmm. It's a big study. And the sociologist set out what MTD is, and he gives reasonable definitions. Seems to be a pretty smart guy for a sociologist. Okay. Defines terms first, and then he asks people a question. He gave a great survey. And he's showing how the answers are delivering what he's already predefined as MTD. Yeah. And it's just moralistic, meaning, and the moralistic part isn't, you know, thou shalt not. It's just literally be nice, make people feel good, confirm them. It's basically the psychotherapeutic establishment making people be nice.
Right.
Being nice is not moral. Jesus was really not nice a lot of the time, but he was, you know, perfect and loving. Yeah. Therapeutic means. So the moralistic part is basically what you do to confirm other people's. Therapeutic is basically what the religion and what others should be doing for you, what you get. And deism meaning God is just kind of whoever you want him to be. He is out there. He's not actively involved in your life. He doesn't care about things. He's this sort of enlightenment type God, if there is one, that's just somewhere out there. And you sort of pray to him when you're in a jam, and he probably doesn't really care even then.
Yeah.
But he hasn't really imposed any rules on you. You live your life separate from him. He's not the center of your life. And basically, it turns out most people in the burbs are these high-functioning atheists that just worship at the altar of MTD. And I believed this before I read it, you know?
Right.
I believed it before I read it. And I remember I read it third year of law school. And I was like, oh, yeah, this is how I believe most of these people are. Yeah. I mean, you walk around. There's no other way to justify everybody's behavior.
You go to your normal local Catholic parish and just man on the street interview people and just say, ask them things like, does a person need grace to get to heaven? No. Do they need sacraments? No. Are there ways to heaven besides Jesus? Yes, of course. I mean, this is just broadly accepted in Catholic American culture.
Yes.
There is nothing special about Catholicism. We are one of the options, and maybe they'll go above and beyond and be a conservative Catholic and say, like Bishop Barron, well, it's the privileged path.
Right.
Right. So there's all these paths. It's the best one. I looked into it, spent some time.
Right.
It's the best one. It's the privileged one, but they all work.
Right. Jesus is necessary, but he's not really necessary. Yeah. When, yeah, I am the way, the truth, and the life. That meant I'm the privileged path. And that, yeah, like you said, even a lot of people who are in their secular lives, conservatives, and who do try to practice, who are Catholic, even they fall into it. Exactly. Yeah. That's the whole
liberal
point.
Will say, well, yeah, let's have an imam come do a Lenten retreat. Same difference, right? But the conservatives, scare quotes, will actually say, well, no, there is something unique and special about Jesus and the Catholic Church. We need to hold that out there. And that's considered to be very conservative. But then there's this whole other group of people that are like, no, Jesus is the only way, as he said in John 14:6. And you're like, whoa, are you a Nazi? You said that?
Yeah, yeah. Even the conservatives will go, yeah, whoa, yeah. Are you a Nazi, bro? You're like, whoa, can I do
like, wait, are you a Sedevi contest? And you're like, no, I'm not a Sedevi contest.
No, I just literally believe Jesus. Even, and then you take, then I relish pointing out to the conservative who is a Catholic but doesn't believe the Bible. I'm like, even like hardcore Protestants believe what I believe, you know, because it's true. Even the ones that really believe the Bible and take the New Testament literally.
No one comes to the Father except through me.
Yeah.
We believe it. Yeah.
We believe it. So this is where the conservative who is a Catholic doesn't want to be second to some evangelical just on the basis of the Bible. Because a lot of times the conservative who is a Catholic knows that he's got the three teaching pillars, right? The magisterium, tradition, and scripture. They might even know that much. They just don't really take any of the three pillars seriously on their own merit. So they're like, I don't want to be bested. I'm not a liberal. I don't want to be bested by evangelicals. So I've had this conversation probably more often than I've had the conversation with the liberal or the evangelical over the last 5 years. And they're like, really? But that just sounds so like exclusive. It sounds so unloving. Where's the love? You know, they always hit you with loving as a participle or a participial phrase. We're like, but I thought Jesus was loving. It's like your definition of love. Of course he is. He's love incarnate, according to John the evangelist. But your MTD definition of love, where it's just nicey-nicey and hooray for everything, here comes everybody. No, he's not. That's not it. He called his friend Satan, called the woman at the well a dog. You know, the better translation for this is never given. He calls her a dog, the female a dog. I mean, he's hardcore. He's the truth. Yeah. The truth is loving in a certain sense, but it's deep love. It's not moral therapeutic love, moralistic therapeutic love. So I think it's a couple really important dispositions with regard to Francis and evangelization. I mean, MTD and Catholicism reaches its zenith with Francis pontificate.
It does. And the Go Make a Difference hymns and the, you know, well, we've already gone through it all. There's the horse is beaten.
There's the whole thing.
You know, I watched the Luther documentary that basically broke the internet when you mentioned on it. Everybody's like, how do we get the Luther, you know? And I watched that. Yeah. It's on Vimeo. People are like, it's on Vimeo. It's not on Amazon.
No.
And then you can buy the DVD or you can rent it on Vimeo. And everyone watching should go watch it. But what's interesting in there, Tim, because I'm thinking about this whole evangelizing Africa and all that and what is evangelization? Mm-hmm. Luther and Melanchthon told that prince, I think it was Philip of Hesse, that he could take a second wife.
I know.
Remember that?
I know. It wasn't
he
just
was
the
married
English
and he was jonesing for his maid. And he's like, I just can't take anymore. I need to sleep with this woman. What am I going to do, Luther? And Luther said, well, in this case, if you marry her in secret and don't make a big deal about it, you have our permission. So he did. And guess what? Everybody found out about it. And then Luther said, well, it's okay. You can't implicate us. It's okay to lie. It's for the true gospel.
Right.
Luther said that. It's like, what a joke Lutheranism is.
It's a joke. Yeah,
it's that right there is less consistent than a Muslim, a Mohammedan.
Right. Though they also have the Quran does also allow a very similar principle that they are allowed to lie.
Yes,
they're allowed assimilation
for
lies.
So
what an assimilation lie is pretend like, hey, bro, I'm part of your culture. You know, let's NBA, NFL, whatever. When they're in the minority, but except the second that they're not in the minority, then they're expected to, whatever. But that reminded me of that, actually, of Luther saying, like, in this case, you know, you're a prince and we want to back me up.
You're a Lutheran. I'm Luther. If you can't help yourself with this young maid in your home, you can marry her. But just, you know, don't implicate us. And then when it's out in the public, he's like, you can lie.
Right. I mean, that's basically what the documentary, and I have been trying to source some of that stuff. So the last week and weeks, a couple weeks, just to make sure. It's a great, great documentary.
No,
if it's all true.
When I was a Protestant, I knew that about, I'd heard that story of Philip of Hesse. It was kind of that's a bad take. That
one's sourceable.
Yeah.
What was most important to me after I watched that is sourcing.
The duel, right?
The origin story, which is the duel instead, because that really makes him just the first kind of modern, pre-modern instance. I consider that modern. I go back further than most people with modernism. Mm-hmm. I actually think it's the Reformation. That makes him the first kind of Taylor R. Marshall infiltration book infiltrator. Right.
It does.
Because if he goes in literally just as kind of like one of Bella Dodd's men.
Yeah.
Like, except a little bit less determined as an a reverse ideologue, and more just like, you know, his friends are like, what's with the, why are you, what are you doing? Why'd you leave Erfurt? You know, the center of nominalism where he's learning all that nominalistic study of law. What the hell are you doing? Why would you go to a Catholic monastery? Ew. And he's like, I know, very ew, right? But if I leave this cloak, if I leave this damn monkish cloak, they're going to take my head. So that means he's an infiltrator, and that makes everything else make sense. How do you go from 1517, whatever we're taught he believed in 1517, which is doctrinally rather pure, to 1519, 1520, then all of a sudden he's like, no, we can change everything. It really means the center, the thesis of the video, again, is, since you brought up the prince, the center of Protestantism is the G.K. Chesterton quote, like, no one's ever tried Christianity and found it wanting. They tried it and found it hard, and so made up new relativistic rules.
Right.
I butchered the quote, but that's what it is. It's just he's going to confession 30 times a day because he didn't want to do away with his sin of the flesh. And he's like, this is super inconvenient. What if I just added the word alone to we are justified by faith, which he did? What if I just chop off a book or two? Like the letter of James, and which talks about works. And wouldn't this be a sweet deal if Christianity were the religion of justification by faith alone, no works? It's like, I'd probably agree with you, but it's just not the truth. Doctrine matters. Brings us back to
that would be much easier.
Super.
And this is why people say Francis is a Lutheran. It's the same Philip of Hesse situation, but multiplied by thousands across the face of the earth. This man divorced his wife years later, his Catholic wife. Years later, he married another woman. Now he wants to come back to Mass with this new woman. Kind of awkward, weird situation. There's not an annulment. And Francis says, don't go and say it out loud. But in private, you can allow him to keep his second wife and receive the Eucharist. That's some Mars Letizia, folks.
Foro interno, right? The eternal forum.
So it's just like Luther. As long as you keep it on the down low, it's good, right?
Which is very telling.
It's Luther. It's the same situation as Philip of Hesse. Also, you have the faith aloneism, which is in Pope Francis. Just believe.
Yeah.
Right? No radical change in life.
No, it's good.
And then you've got the statue.
It kind of dies down, though. For Francis, just to insert real fast, it's kind of faith and sort of love. Right. Faith and love alone.
Mercy.
You get in any faith. Yeah, Luther was more hardcore than Francis on faith alone,
true,
I think. Yeah,
true. And then you've got, the statue of Luther there with Francis, and you got the stamp in 2017, 500 years of Luther. And it's not just like a picture of Luther. Did you notice the Vatican chose Luther and Melanchthon kneeling before a crucifix?
Did they?
Have you seen the stamp?
I did. I've seen the stamp in October 2017. I haven't seen it since
then. I think it's the image that's over the door in Wittenberg currently. I might be wrong on that. Lutheran German people, please correct me if I am. I think it's the image that's over the door at Wittenberg, and it has Luther on one side of the crucifix and Melanchthon on the other side of the crucifix, and they're devoutly kneeling before Jesus. So it's actually showing Luther in a posture of worship and prayer, which is commendable, but that's what the Vatican is promoting.
This reminds me strongly. That's interesting you say that. Reminds me strongly of something Louis Bouillet says. I know you're not a Bouillet fan, but he makes some really good points in this book I'm using for my sacraments class. It's called The Word, Church, and Sacraments. It's a little book. And he starts out kind of pastoral, saying, okay, on the first third of the book, it's on the Word and how the Protestants do have the Word, even though it's a cut-up Bible. Redacted yeah. Bible. He doesn't really talk about that. But then once he gets to church, and they don't have church because they don't have bishops, apostolic lineage, and then they can't have sacraments, he gets pretty hardcore, gets surprisingly hardcore. One thing he says, though, even in the first third when he's talking about scripture, he says, what is the Protestant piety? He's a converted Protestant, you know?
Yeah. He was a Lutheran.
So he comes in and he says, throughout that first third, he's kind of setting aside higher Protestantism, like more Catholic Protestantism, like right. Lutheranism and Anglicanism. But in this part, he's really honest as he's going from part one to part two, where his critiques really begin in earnest. He says, what is this Protestant piety? And he says that, you know, the Lutherans will tell you it's, you know, the Christian on his knees in prayer with his hands locked with the Bible in front of him.
Yes.
But then he goes on to admit very robustly, but without bishops and church, you know, ecclesia and sacraments, the piety comes to nothing. And this isn't really even how they're reading the Bible anyway. It becomes more like a book club. Think about a low
book
church.
Study.
But yeah, book study. That's what Sunday is. That's the Mass. We have the divine sacrifice of the Mass. The holy sacrifice, the bloodless sacrifice. We're supposed to have altars. That's what Sunday's for. It's not what you can read the Bible any time of the week. You could read the Bible, you know, before you take a nap.
You could have a Bible study every day. Right? I mean, you know,
yeah. It's a good idea.
Yeah.
But yeah, so that's the point, is he shows very honestly, I believe, by the second part, that when you're pitching this, you're like, get this. I mean, like Luther, no more sexual mores. No. We're faith alone.
That's right.
And no more Mass on Sunday. If you want to just stay home, well, it's cold outside. You want to stay home, read the Bible on your own? You can have it just as holy. You know, this is how ideas always start out and then they slide. Yeah. You can be with everyone in your family. You can even get prayer rugs. You can be on your knees for longer than you would have been on your knees at Mass. Mm-hmm. And you have the Bible in front of you and all that. But the second you start loosening, playing fast and loose with the rules, you know how it goes. Then it's just like, okay, you're just paid. Oh, I'll read a short chapter of scripture today, you know, at halftime in the Cowboys game or whatever.
Right.
So I think that was that's an insightful passage by Bouillet, but it reminded me of what you're saying.
Look, people, doctrine comes first, not evangelization. It's the cart out in front of the horse.
That's right.
When you see that quote, it's a Michael Scott moment. My, how the turntables have turned.
how the turntables have. Then David Wallace is just looking at him.
He's like, what?
That's one
analogy gone wrong. That's what it is. I mean, You got to have doctrine. You got to have truth. This is why a man goes through 7, 8, 9 years of seminary before he is ordained a priest, before he becomes an evangelizer. Right. He's got to learn all the doctrine. So first, he studies the philosophy. Then he studies the theology. Maybe throw in some languages for missionary work. And then he receives ordination and then he goes out.
It makes a difference.
It makes a difference. Evangelization first doesn't make any sense.
No. Yeah. What message are you bringing? You haven't learned anything. I always said that people are going to be flooding my inbox with whatever, but it's kind of like, at least in theory, when people are like, when you're an education major and then you get a teaching credential, it's like, yeah, but what subject? It's an empty set, isn't it? What subject have you learned to teach? You know,
right.
It's kind of like you have to learn to, at least to teach high school, you got to learn some subject to be kind of a master in it. You don't have to be a master to the same extent you do to teach university, but don't you have to learn the subject and then you can learn some teaching skills as you go, right? Like, but some states get really doctrinaire about having a teaching credential. It's like, but what if all I know how to do is teach, but I don't have anything to teach? That's kind of how it feels, yeah. With, you know, evangelization comes before doctrine. Doctrine is what I'd be evangelizing. So if, yeah, we beat the horse, I guess.
Right. Well, and canon law says seminarians have to study. It's very loose on what you have to study. Canon law, right here. Thomas Aquinas in Latin. That's what we're required. And yet, how many hundreds of seminarians have I met and said, how much Latin are you taking? None. Or we have half a semester on it. How much Thomas Aquinas? Well, some in some of the courses we take. It's like, guys, you had one job. Seminary is supposed to have Latin and Thomas Aquinas in it. You're not even hitting that.
Wow.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
Well, Tim, you know, we kind of messed up. We were going to do communion in the hand in Chile. We're going to do Francis on giving the $500,000.
Yeah,
and Cardinal Casper, but we might have to change that. We might have to just delay those till the next day we record.
But sure, whatever. I mean, denied kneeling communion, people probably just want to hear us say a few derogatory things about that. Or yes. Do you want to really table it? I mean, definitely Casper, we got it. That's a whole topic of its own. You just want
Casper has come out and said that he didn't really participate in selecting Bergoglio or having any pre-meetings, but it is true that right before the election of Bergoglio, he was part of a meeting that tallied votes for Bergoglio. So,
I was part of no meetings about Bergoglio as Pope. I did, however, go to this one get together about Bergoglio as the Bishop of Rome, but totally different
totally
things.
Different,
it's like,
totally different.
No. Thank you. That's the same thing. You lied, but you told the truth at the same time. Yeah.
Oh, so yeah. So you don't. I think we should just hit it now. I mean, we're out of time. You gotta head out.
All right.
And I think we got a riff of at least 5 or 10 minutes on that one. So
yeah.
I don't know if we can get it all in there, but
all right.
This is a good show. So as usual, folks, pray the rosary. We're recording this. I think today's the St. Pius V feast day. The guy who organized the Battle of Lepanto, instituted the feast of Our Lady of Victory, which becomes Our Lady of the Rosary because he and all of Europe were praying that rosary while they fought the Mohammedans on the sea in the Battle of Lepanto. Go read, it's G.K. Chesterton, right? The Lepanto?
What about it? The
poem.
Lepanto.
The poem.
The poem. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
Go read that.
I believe so.
That's pretty awesome. Mm-hmm. And so pray that rosary because we are in a battle now, doctrinal, here amongst our own people, and then also exteriorly from the Mohammedan, Saracen. So pray that rosary, go to Mass, have peace, have joy, look to Jesus Christ. Don't be afraid to make big changes. Conform yourself to the cross.
And don't do drugs, as the guy says at his talk on City Slickers. And don't do drugs.
Amen to that. All right. So like the video, hit the bell, subscribe, support on Patreon. If you're on iTunes, leave a review. We're out.